Good evening. My name is Amanda Cater, and I'm a member of the Planning Committee for the Power of We, which is a collaboration of Pilgrim Congregational Church, Temple Beth Shalom, and the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bozeman. I want to thank the Bozeman Chronicle and the library for their sponsorship of these forums. And I also want to thank the other members of the Planning Committee, Katie Cady and Mary Wagner from Pilgrim, Janelle Carino from Temple Beth Shalom, Sarah Williams and Janet Lewis from the Unitarian Fellowship, and Dr. Linda Young from MSU. My thanks also to Steve Durbin and Bob Wall from Gallatin Community Radio for recording these events. Last spring, after the Newtown tragedy, several people felt that the Power of We should sponsor some kind of discussion about guns and gun safety and responsibility. And at that time, we decided that the issue was much bigger than just guns in our society, and so we began to plan for a series of forums on the topic of violence in American culture. During these forums, several questions have been raised about mental health issues. It seems that people with various forms of mental illness are not getting the treatment they need and/or are getting access to guns. As our chief of police said last week, in many cases, guns are not stored securely. People are also wondering if we undergo a process of becoming desensitized to violent images so they become socially acceptable. The speakers in the second forum on domestic abuse indicated that our society has become very accepting of violence. Are there ways that we can change this culture? How can we better support treatment for those with mental illness? Our first speaker this evening is Scott Malloy, director of the Gallatin Mental Health Center. Scott is a native Montanan and holds a bachelor's degree in sociology and psychology and a master's of social work. He is licensed as a clinical social worker and certified as a mental health professional. Scott.
Thanks for having me here tonight. I just think it's wonderful that most of the faces I see here I don't know. I only see a couple faces. I do speak quite a bit in the community. I'd say probably once a quarter I'm asked to go to a civic organization or a church organization and talk about mental health. And usually it leads to not necessarily talking about violence, but it's talking about crisis situations, kind of where the status of mental health is in this community. So it's really great to see new faces here. One of my missions is to educate, ask questions, and kind of make this, you know, community more accepting of mental illness and mental health so that people feel comfortable about getting help. So thank you for being here. I work for the Gallatin Mental Health Center. We are a nonprofit organization, employ around 100 individuals, and have a mental health center here in Bozeman and in Livingston. And I've been here for almost 6 years, and working for the organization I've been about 7.5 years. This is briefly some of the stuff that we do. It would be considered comprehensive mental health services, mostly for adults 18 and over. We are starting to, you know, provide services to children over the last 3.5 years, and that'll be our main focus moving forward, is to expand the children's services. We have a jail diversion program. Some of this stuff I won't get into in detail, but I am happy to speak to any of you if you have questions about the specific programs that are listed here. We have our campus is on East Hagerty, so if you know where the Life of Montana building is, keep driving and on your right. We have the Hope House that I'll talk about today. We have a drop-in center, an outpatient building, supported housing. And then we have, you know, a jail diversion program out of the detention center here, as well as these other services. Here's what I hope to go over tonight. I have 20 minutes, I hear, so I'm going to try and be concise. Here's kind of what I'm going to briefly go over, is what does the research say about mental health and violence? So I'm going to touch on that. I'm going to talk about what the mental health system here is. What is the mental health system here in your community? What does that look like for people that want to seek care? And specifically, what happens in crisis situation where we are concerned about the dangerousness of that individual? What does that look like here in this community? what do the laws say in Montana about what we can and cannot do for individuals who may have a mental illness and may be dangerous? Okay? And then I'm going to get into very specific statistics in this community about the type of evaluations that we do, what happens with those evaluations, where do people go, what kind of problems are we seeing when somebody comes in for evaluation, and how do they come to us? Okay? So let's jump right into it. This is a recent article that I saw. Basically, everything that I've seen, and I don't seek out this literature very much, but this is talking about the correlation between people with mental illness and violence. A lot of stuff that was mentioned as far as these tragedies and these horrific events that occur. If you want to read the full article, you can see it there. It's cited, Clinical and Research News. Basically, what is summarized from this is that there is no correlate between mental illness and violence. So that might come to some surprise, but if you look at the actual research and most of what I've seen is that's pretty typical. And what is interesting, though, is substance use disorders. So that is obviously something that came out of this study, that that is a correlate, that, you know, substance abuse does kind of lead to increased violence. Okay, I'm not going to read this fully, but that's kind of a snippet of that article. It goes on to say, again, it references some of the mass killings, that there is this widespread belief that mental illness is an important cause of firearm violence and mass murder. In fact, researchers found no relationship between the presence of psychiatric disorders and the use of firearms, nor did the presence of psychiatric disorder relate to offense involving multiple victims. And it goes on to talk about that. This is important because, I mean, we can debate about whether people that have mental illness, you know, have been involved in these tragedies. I think it's clear that many of them did. And Dennis is going to talk about the role the media plays. I'm not going to get into that. My interest in this is the number one reason why people do not seek help is because of the stigma of mental illness. So my concern from a mental health professional and advocate is when I see this stuff, the obvious horrific things that have occurred are clear, and it makes you sick. But it's also the people that are having uncomfortable symptoms that might be needing to get help end up seeing how people that have mental illness are portrayed, and it prevents them from getting help. And we see that all the time. So that prevents somebody from getting help on the front door. We always encourage all of us, this is what we preach, is most of us have wellness that we adhere to. We should eat well. We should be healthy. We should exercise. We should work. We should have support systems. We should have a spiritual belief. For some people, that's not enough. A chronic and persistent mental illness is present, and they need to get professional help. Now, if you're that person who's kind of wavering on whether or not you should get help, and you see images of people with mental illness that are called maniacs and are called homicidal maniacs, et cetera, you're more apt to not go in and get help. So you end up getting worse, and that leads to bad things. Who's involved in our system here? This is in our local community. So we're talking now about when an individual has a mental illness, or it's perceived that they have a mental illness, and that person may be dangerous. Who is involved in our community? Okay, these are some of the main people that end up getting involved. Clearly, the individual themselves, family, friends, supports, law enforcement. I'll talk about their role as we go along too. One of the cool things we've done here is that the majority of law enforcement in this community, especially the Sheriff's Office and the Bozeman Police Department, not as much but growing, have gone through a 40-hour evidence-based training called Crisis Intervention Training, which is a training that teaches about mental illness, teaches about the signs and symptoms. When they go out to calls, how do they handle those situations a little bit different so that they can intervene in a different way instead of just arresting people or escalating the situation? So this is something we've been doing for the last 5 years in conjunction with the Sheriff's Office. Had a tremendous amount of success with that. And you get into more of the legal folks. We'll talk about how this process goes. This is very much a legal process when somebody is thought to have a mental illness and may be dangerous. The county attorney's involved, public defenders, the district court, some of the other non-legal folks, the help center, which is a crisis line. We use them as well, the hospital, ourselves, and the Montana State Hospital. Okay? This is our law that governs the treatment of individuals with mental illness. If you are interested and want a really, really dry read, go search the Montana Code annotated. And it's 87 some pages about everything you would ever want to know and not know about what needs to happen when people with mental illness are kind of evaluated, the process that happens, etc. It's very important because this law dictates everything that happens. It's a law. And what I would say is this law, as in other laws in our state that deal with kind of social issues, reflect the people in the state. So we tend to be a more frontier state, a little bit more conservative. We value individual rights in Montana. How many people are from Montana in here, grew up? We got all transplants in here. Okay. So think about your own state that you came from. You know, just the value that was placed on individual rights, kind of what the political kind of scene was there as far as government involvement versus kind of the individual's, you know, right to kind of be who they are. Montana's law reflects that. So our law tends to be a little bit more conservative with regards to how people can be detained when they have a mental illness. Okay? There's other states that are a little bit more liberal, and it is a little easier to get somebody detained and get them evaluated and treated. Okay? So for example, in Florida, there's a law, I think it's called the Baker Act, which resulted in a tragedy like most laws do. Any individual can kind of request that somebody gets a hold put on them and they can be, you know, detained for a period of time and then court gets involved. In Montana, you can't do that. And I'll walk through what that process is here that you can do. So this law dictates all of these processes as far as what happens. A mental health professional, that's a certification in Montana that basically allows you to recommend that an individual is detained against their will because they're a danger to themselves or others. Okay, a mental health professional has to determine that. Emergency detention is when that mental health professional determines that person is a danger to themselves or others, that individual is locked up against their will for a period of time to determine if they need to be committed. Okay? Commitment is what occurs after that emergency detention process to determine if that person needs to be committed for a long period of time, up to 90 days. Okay? Brief history in this community, 4 years ago, if you were somebody that required, you know, emergency detention, you were a danger to yourself or others, it was determined you needed that, you went up to Warm Springs. You went up in a cop car with two deputies, and you came back sometimes two times because there's hearings that have to occur. There's two hearings in that process. The first hearing is about reading you your rights and kind of what's being alleged that is happening, and the second hearing is whether or not you meet the commitment threshold. All that was occurring up and down the highway to Warm Springs. 3.5 years ago, and this is a shortened version, we now have the Hope House, which we can do that locally here at the Hope House, so people can stay here, and they only go to Warm Springs if a commitment is warranted. Okay? Very important shift in this community, which is really cool. So let's talk about the actual data here in this community. Okay? The crisis response team is the mental health professional team that goes out and does the evaluations for individuals that have a mental illness or perceived to have a mental illness and they may be a danger to themselves or others. Okay? So it's a team of professionals that's on call. We have one person on call a day, and they serve Gallatin, Park, and Madison counties. Okay? And so this is the numbers. That's that first chart. It's kind of hard to see here. That's the light blue. So the light blue is the number of evaluations that we've conducted in these fiscal years. There we go. Is that better? So the light blue is the number of evaluations that our crisis response team conducted. So these are for people, again, this is an emergency evaluation. Okay? Over 1,600 evaluations last fiscal year. So that had been July of 2012 to June of 2013. The dark blue is the number of evaluations that we conducted in Gallatin County. So that accounts for the majority of them. Obviously, the other ones would be Park and Madison County. Okay, this is a very, very high volume. The white line is Hope House, the number of individuals that we've served at Hope House, which is our crisis stabilization facility. So this is a facility, we have 8 beds on the voluntary side and 2 beds on the emergency detention side. And I'll talk about what that difference is here in a minute. So that's the number of individuals we've served in this community at that crisis stabilization facility. Questions about this?
Yes. Do you put people who are at risk of hurting themselves together with people who are at risk hurting others?
As far as in treatment?
Yeah.
Yeah, we basically at a crisis house, there's all walks of life there. So there's presenting issues from mania to psychosis to suicide to violence, et cetera, et cetera.
So those 8 beds in Hope House, they not only have people who are suicidal, but people who act out violently.
Yes. But I'll get into that, the numbers of what that actually looks like. Okay? Yes?
Why do you think fiscal year 12 is so much lower?
I was wondering if somebody was going to ask that. I don't know. That's a simple answer. I think time will tell, but I would say that was kind of on in the middle of kind of the recession, and it might seem that they would be higher then, but I think we see kind of a volume of kind of influx of workers that maybe aren't kind of local, and I think that might be a correlate there, is that there wasn't as many people here during that time, but I'm kind of speculating. So these evaluations, let me throw some kind of info at you here. The majority of these do not involve law enforcement at all. I'd say it's less than 5 or 10% have anything to do with law enforcement. That come as a surprise to you? These are emergency evaluations. These are people that come in themselves. Family members bring them in. They're referred by loved ones or friends. They just want to get help. They want something to change in their life, and it's gotten pretty bad. Nothing to do with law enforcement, vast majority of these. These are the presenting problems that we see from our crisis team. If you can't see that, that's suicidal risk. Okay, very clear who we are seeing. All of you know that Montana has been in the top 5 for suicide for the last 70 years. I hope you're all aware of that. Is everybody aware of that? Okay. We have been, since they've tracked suicide, we have been in the top 5, and in many years, number 1 as far as suicide rates. So when you want to talk about violence, most of the violence occurs to the individuals themselves. Easily 75-80% of the people we see have just attempted suicide or have a serious suicide gesture, or they're seriously considering suicide. That's who we see, the vast majority of the people we see. Violence homicide risk right there, 54. So it's less than 2%. And when you consider 1,600 plus. The other things you can kind of see, there's various stuff that's going on, depression, there's unable to protect self, that's kind of psychosis stuff, family dysfunction, so a variety of other things. Now, when law enforcement does get involved, it's not good, right? So the person's done something or somebody's called and it's not good. The person generally is not willing to come in and address things. So law enforcement has to get involved. And the law, the Montana Code Law, states that law enforcement has the authority to place an individual in protective custody if they appear to have a mental illness and appear to, or maybe be a danger to themselves or others. Law enforcement can take them into custody until a mental health professional can evaluate what needs to occur. Okay? And that very rarely happens, again, when law enforcement has to get to that level when you take the great number of evaluations that we are conducting. But when law enforcement does get involved, it's not good, because those individuals are not willing or they're not able to seek help. So they have to be handled with law enforcement and the legal system. Questions on this?
Numbering from left to right, I don't know, I'm just not able to read stats right, but 863 cases in Gallatin and Oil Center, of suicide risk in a year. And so these aren't rankings, they're just
pure numbers.
Different things.
Pure data. This is just Gallatin. So Park and Madison are pulled out of this. It looks the same if you were to look at their charts too. Just not as high. There's not as many.
And it's just this year, right?
This is just the fiscal year we just ended.
I used to work at the driver license office, and I was over there today, and the staff were all shaken up. Apparently within the last few days, there was an individual there who had to be removed by the police, and it was apparently a very difficult situation, certainly for that individual and for anybody who witnessed it. What happens to such an individual?
Well, one of two things. Yeah, I have no idea about what that was, but one of two things would happen is one, law enforcement would, hopefully a CIT or crisis intervention trained officer would respond if there was some sense that this individual might have some mental health issues. They would come out and make a determination on whether or not this person did indeed have some mental health issues and whether or not they had enough as far as safety is concerned to place the person in protective custody. Then they would be brought in for an evaluation and then make a determination on what happens at that point. If that's not made, then they would just arrest them probably and they would put them in jail. The movement is hopefully to identify those folks that the mental illness or is driving that behavior and that gets dealt with before the criminal or the legal stuff does. Okay, location of emergency evaluations. So where do these evaluations occur? So when somebody needs an emergency evaluation, where does it happen? If you look at fiscal year 2009, the light blue one is Bozeman Deaconess Hospital. That's the light blue line. This was that shift that I talked about really quickly 3.5-4 years ago where we didn't have a local crisis system. We didn't have a Hope House. We didn't have any of that stuff. Everybody defaulted to the ER. Kind of makes sense, right? The ER is open 24/7. You can't turn people away. Makes sense, but it's not really a good way to do it. It's costly. The ER is not a kind of a therapeutic environment for that. You don't want all of the evaluations to occur there. It's not the best place for those folks to get help. So we made a really concerted effort with our partners in this community to have different access points. So if people weren't doing well, they could go directly to the Hope House to get an evaluation and have it done in a mental health, a therapeutic setting, and not have to go to the ER unless they really needed to because there was medical issues, substance issues, etc. So this is what's happened. It's pretty cool to look at this. The majority of the evaluations in this community now occur at the Hope House, not the ER. That's a pretty cool shift. GCDC is the Gallatin County Detention Center. So that's the jail, and some of those are, you know, after the person's there, you know, for a couple months, they might not be adjusting well, or maybe they're not adjusting well. After a day there, some people come in and they might be intoxicated, and the shock of being arrested for, you know, a 20-year-old is, oh my gosh, I'm gonna do something to myself that's not good. Those people we evaluate for safety and try and manage those folks as well.
I have a question.
Yes.
Who runs Hope House?
Gallatin Mental Health Center. That's us.
Okay. And you have other programs besides Hope House.
Oh yeah, that was on that whole list of Hope House, Crisis Response Team, outpatient services, which is the brunt of what we do is outpatient services, which is people coming in because they want help.
Yeah.
And that's the majority of what we do. We have vocational programs, case management. We serve acute situational issues like divorce or just stress, and then all the way up to chronic and severe mental illness. All walks of life.
But all this is voluntary, if they don't agree to voluntary.
Yes. We're going to get into that in the next slide, I think, is what happens. All this is the vast majority of people, even in crisis, they want help. They recognize this is not okay. I'm not doing well. What can I do to get help? That's well over, if you'll see in a second, out of our 1,600 evaluations, it's over 95% of the people want help. So it works really well for those folks. And the folks that don't want help or they can't or they're unwilling or unable, then there's the legal process that is kind of referenced as far as the Montana Code of what we can do as far as our community and kind of the resources we have. Yes?
Is there ever a chance that you're going to be able to to intervene with people getting thrown in jail for up to 6 months to a year before they can actually get treatment? Is there going to be a time when these people will be able to go right to a facility like Hope House under a court order, even confined there, but get the intensive treatment? Because when you sit in jail, the horror, the fear, the violence, it does not do well for people who have had episodes, mental episodes. It does not help anybody by having somebody sit in jail and generally become worse.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't make bond. They're stuck. They're in jail.
Yeah, I think that we've made some strides but have some work to go. And I think some of that comes down to the community acceptance of that. So we can train law enforcement and have them take folks to mental health facilities instead of jails. If they end up in jail, we have mental health staff in the jail to treat them while they're there. But if you have a felony, the county attorney is going to be a little bit reluctant to release you to the community because of public safety. I think some of that is kind of what we're talking about here today, is how does that kind of all work from the point of kind of contact through that individual's treatment and kind of the legal system.
Can I add a comment?
Yes.
It seems to me when a person does get thrown in jail, that is the absolute time they need intensive help.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, they committed a felony. Lock them down in Hope House. They can get treatment around the clock there. You know, it just seems like somebody's trying to get even with people that have mental problems. They're going to show you by throwing you in jail and give you a bond that's, you know, $100,000 for acting out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to create sympathy for people like that, but I think that point right there, you know, the bars and the atmosphere of the jail, it does not help your attitude.
Yeah, you know, I think this is really the public discussion about, you know, what's the public comfort with having individuals that may be dangerous with mental illness out in the community versus locked up. I think that's really the relevant discussion really that is guiding what we're talking about today. Is you hear the rhetoric of how can these people be on the streets, they need to be locked up. And there's the other wave that is, these people need to be in the least restrictive environment, they need treatment, they need all that stuff, and they're not going to get better if they're locked up. So I think that's kind of what we have as converging opinions on that. Emergency detentions. This is the process by which the individual is brought in by law enforcement in protective custody. Law enforcement has made that determination. This individual appears to have a mental illness and may be a danger to themselves or others. The mental health professional, which is us, Gallatin Mental Health Crisis Response Team, we come in and evaluate the individual. And at this point, this is who we have determined needs to be placed in emergency detention. And we work with the county attorney and the district court on that. Okay, so out of the 1,600 people that we evaluated last fiscal year, these are the people, this is the number of folks that we placed in emergency detention. So some basic math here, we're looking at 30, 20, 15, so about 60 to 65 people out of the 1,600. So that goes back to my point that it's a very small percentage that we're talking about here that actually is unable or unwilling to get help. Okay? This is the process that is outlined in the Montana Code. So again, reference, the individual gets placed in detention at the Hope House. They have a first hearing that basically says, this is what the mental health professional said, and these are the events that occurred that brought you here. It doesn't look good. There's some concern for your safety or the public safety. Do you have any questions or concerns about that? Do you understand what's going on here? And the individual at that time can say, I don't contest this. I need help. Send me to Warm Springs.
But the only way that someone, not the person in question, can involuntarily commit another person is if that person has done harm to themselves or someone else.
Yes, and that goes back to the point that when you talk about...
So it's not proactive, it's after the fact.
Yeah. This in Montana, the threshold is that you have an imminent threat to yourself or others. not, things aren't going well, we're concerned about you, you kind of seem like you're a little bit odd, or things don't seem like they've been going well for you, there has to be an imminent threat to yourself or others in order for this threshold to be met. It's a very high threshold in Montana, very high. So there's a lot of folks, I mean, if you look at, the other way to look at this is out of the 1,600 people that we saw, those 800 and some, that a lot of them have just had a suicide attempt, those people are not being detained. They're going home or getting voluntary treatment, and that's a cool thing, but very few people actually meet that criteria, and it's kind of frustrating for family members, for professionals to see that happen, but this is a law that we have to work with. So you can see somebody, everybody can see that person deteriorating very quickly, and there's not a lot we can do unless there's an imminent threat. And so unfortunately, that individual keeps going down and deteriorating, and something might happen, which is unfortunate, but that's the threshold that's in Montana. So this white bar here is at that first hearing where the individual says, I need help, send me to Warm Springs. That's where they go. That's called stipulate. They go. Okay? The blue bar is at the second hearing. There's another evaluation, and this is a court proceeding. There's a district court judge. There's a county attorney and a public defender. It's determined based on the recommendation of the mental health professional and based on the law that that individual doesn't meet the commitment criteria and they're willing to seek voluntary treatment, so they get voluntary treatment in some capacity. That's that blue bar. The light blue bar is at the end of that second hearing. It's determined that that individual does indeed present as a danger to self or others and they need to be committed to the Montana State Hospital. So here's Park County. Again, they don't have the volume that we do, but you can kind of see kind of the similar trends as Gallatin. Okay, I probably went over a little bit, but that's, any questions now? Are we holding questions for later? Sure.
I was wondering how accessible your services are in general, and how we have waitlists, and how many people are paying, and how much you pay, and how easy is it for someone who feels without meeting the person?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy. That's what we recommend. I would say right now are probably anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks out for an initial appointment with no crisis situation going on. If you're in crisis, we can see you that day. We accept sliding scale, and so we have a very difficult time continuing to maintain that, but we can do that with the support of the community. So if you come in and you can pay $10, we accept that. But we can only do that because the community donates to our organization, and we can offset that, which is a blessing living in this community. So we really promote that kind of front-end care, as we call it, and we hope that that's the way it occurs, but we do know that most people, unfortunately, are going to wait until things get bad and we have to deal with them in the crisis system.
So are you saying you're locally funded rather than state or federally funded?
Oh, no. The local funds, the donations, allow us to provide the level of charity care that we do. We provided over $325,000 in charity care last year alone. That's charity care. So we can do that because of the local donations that we get to offset that charity care. And then we are a health service organization, so we do commercial insurance, Medicaid, Medicare, Veterans Administration. You know, that's who we would bill. It's an insurance that the individual presents with. And if you don't have insurance, we have a sliding scale. And the sliding scale is really, again, like I said, we can only do that because of the community being very generous. And
so without local support, you wouldn't be able to keep doors open?
Oh, absolutely not, yeah. I mean, $325,000 in charity care, that's not chump change. That's a lot of money. So we have some very generous donors, and we continue to need assistance for that because every year it grows. It's not like this problem is getting better. Every year you have more people that need help. And don't even get me going on the Affordable Care Act and all that stuff. That's a whole different talk. But Medicaid expansion and all that stuff, that's a different talk. But there is still a tremendous gap of people who need help, not just mental health, but don't have insurance and therefore have limited access to care.
Scott, in terms of suicide, is there a relationship there? Well, one thing the chief of police said is major suicide rate here is between 15 and 24, 27. And it just occurs to me that when guns aren't securely stored, as many are not, that gives real access to a young person who's in crisis.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what you see in terms of that.
You repeat the question, Scott.
About suicide and firearms, kind of dynamics that occur with that. I would encourage you all to go to the Department of Public Health and Human Services website in Montana. There is a state suicide prevention plan, if you are not aware of that. It's a very comprehensive document that took years to create. And there is some very fascinating research and statistics and the plan by which the state is trying to undertake to address the suicide epidemic. Very interesting stuff. So if you have, I would encourage you to go there. What I will say, this is very common knowledge, if you're going to kill yourself, you're going to do it with a gun. The incidence of suicide is very high for guns, and it's very high for men. Women attempt suicide at a much higher rate, 4 times that of men, but men succeed in completing suicide with a little more of a firearm. And that's pretty consistent across every state. So, and the whole issue of gun control and stuff in Montana is a tricky issue. I mean, it's you want to talk about securing somebody's weapons in Montana stuff. Again, that's part of our culture is, you know, we want to have access to our stuff and guns, and so that gets a little tricky.
You said statistically there's no correlation between mental health and violence. That can be true when it comes down to the middle school age kid or high school age kid that goes into a school and opens fire.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say that as a blanket. The most recent research article that I found, which was kind of a review of, you know, a couple research articles, indicated the information I presented here. I would tell you most of the stuff that I've seen has indicated no correlation. That doesn't mean there's other stuff out there that says there is. You know, because you're taught, you know, the stuff we see in the school shootings, it's presented that this individual had a mental illness, and it likely is so, but when you correlate that with other violent acts in the country, that's what that's looking at. Is correct. So we don't see the random violence or the reason for the mass murders in Chicago and all that, but we see, again, and this is probably what Dennis will talk about, is we see that stuff about the person with mental illness kind of front page and on the news. That's what we see.
So is anyone in the field of psychology creating a profile of the kid that loses it, or young adult that loses it, and commits these mass murders so that there can be some attempt at early detection?
I don't know if there's a profile, but I tell you that there's clear research on the risk factors, and like bullying is very much a factor that these bullying, you know, kids that are bullied or isolated in school very much have a high risk to kind of not do.
Victims of bullying.
Correct. No, these are kind of outside.
One last question, and then let Dennis talk. For those who are detained against their will or voluntarily at Hope House, what is the nature of the staff?
Good question. Hope House is a 24-hour facility, so it's staffed 24/7, and it's staffed to be.
Who are the staff people?
The 24-hour staff are kind of crisis intervention workers, so they're bachelor's level staff, and then there's a therapist, a mental health professional on site every day. There's a nurse on site, and then a provider rounds every day for medications. So it's a full-time staff, and then there's, you know, the provider that rounds, but it's kind of your typical, you know, nurse, provider, therapist, kind of behavioral specialist type people. And then they have, you know, they're integrated into kind of the system as far as drop-in center, vocational services, case management, all that's kind of part of that as well.
Okay, thank you, Scott.